Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thanks for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined today by Brett Hughes, a longtime friend of mine who, you know, I realized it had been a while since we had caught up and was kind of inspired by my conversation with Brian Reese last Sunday and was like, all right, who's another big bruising defenseman that I can go catch up with and kind of scope the lacrosse landscape, somebody that's got thoughts from kind of soup to nuts of what's going on out there in the world. So, Brett, thanks so much for joining us, man.
Terry, good to catch up with you again. You were right about one thing, for sure. It's been too long.
Well, part of that is because you've been doing very, very many interesting things in your professional life, and perhaps that'll come up throughout this conversation. But I wanted to start with this idea of professionalism because you're back in Southern California. The PLL recently announced that they are moving their headquarters there. You are not just a UVA lacrosse alum, a Central Ohio native, go Golden Bears, someone that I can call on those Buckeye roots with when it comes to college football season, but you were a longtime Major League Lacrosse veteran, an experience of pro lacrosse from multiple facets. And so let's start by just kind of getting your sense of you know, as an observer, how do you regard the development of the Premier Lacrosse League over the course of the last 4 months?
Well, it's been exciting, I think, is the thing that comes to mind most. They obviously, getting to understand a little bit more about who's involved, they've done a really good job of getting the excitement there, I think better than any launch of anything in our sport's history. Paul and his team and the people who are behind that obviously understand how to tell a really good story and get people behind it. So I think it's interesting. They're out here. They move to the place where content is king, above, you know, storytelling and creation. This is the backyard for it, of Los Angeles. So it makes sense with the way that leagues and the way that things are built today. A story is so central to that, and they've done an incredible job of kind of bringing us into the story as they go, but yet also I think it's fair to say there's still a decent amount of mystery. So it seems like there's a reveal every, you know, month, like a professional soccer league in Europe, where it's just constant drama, constant content, constant inundated with updates, but yet we still haven't seen a game. Right. So I'm really proud of what they've done. But I'm also very, very interested to see what's next, which I think is there by design.
Exactly. And you're uniquely well-suited to address this idea. You know, when I talk about the assets at disposal of the Premier Lacrosse League and what differentiates it from not the NLL, because the NLL, by virtue of the venues they play in, by and large has access mm-hmm. to at least one of these aspects, but certainly Major League Lacrosse and the venues they played in. There are two things I come back to. The ability to sell suites, the ability to create hospitality for a corporate environment, right? Like, it's kind of a dirty secret of what modern American professional sports have been about for 20 or 30 years. It's totally changed the financial structure of these things. And then the second thing, and this is a little bit more recently developed and something that, by virtue of your exposure through a lot of different relationships in your life, not the least of which the closest relationship in your life, is the notion of athlete as celebrity and what being a celebrity means in America, in the world, in 2019. And that's the part of PL's ability to create content, the infrastructure of the folks involved with the league and their ability to create content on behalf of the athletes that help to differentiate them from helmeted players on a field or stick-holding coaches in a youth clinic. This is a third opportunity to show them as individuals hanging out with each other and going to places that essentially this culture has shown there's an unending appetite for, you know, from the Kardashians on down. People want to see other people live their lives in a social setting. And I think that, PLL has positioned themselves and demonstrated an understanding of that that gives the opportunity to create new lacrosse fans. And that's the part that really excites me the most. So how do you regard that idea of athlete as celebrity?
Well, how I regard it is, I mean, it's an inevitability. I think that anyone who is in any professional, you know, silo of work, the celebrity, the influential aspect of it has become part of our life. Go to LinkedIn and you'll see everyone vying to be, and I don't, there's no way to, I actually say this about the Kardashians with someone who's never watched that show, but someone who can appreciate, I mean, they built something remarkable, right? That may not be my cup of tea, but they're not really worried about me. They're serving another audience. But go on LinkedIn and you'll see that there is this aspect of, in every professional silo, there's an aspect of being the influencer. And I think sports have so long been behind the shield, behind the logo, behind whatever, and at some point it all broke down. And so what's happened in that is it used to be the best players and the people who got picked by Nike, the people who were on the best teams, they got the lion's share of the opportunities and the publicity. And while that's not true today, I think there's the bit of the extreme sports model where those guys just had cameras and skateboards and surfboards, and they became really good at making content. And I think that Paul in particular, if I, you know, watch his trajectory, he understood that. He almost has like a WWF mindset to it, where he created a persona that allowed, that was very much him, but showing the part of his life that people wanted to engage with. And he's done that incredibly well. I would say my old roommate when we moved out here, Kyle Harrison, has done a really good job of that too. But even he would say that it's being done at a higher and higher level. So I think that it's the way to cut through. I think kids, it all ultimately comes back to story. If you want someone to get involved with anything you do, you're going to have to tell a story that's better than the video game or the Fortnite or whatever is in front of them. And I think that's where the PLL, and if you see every other league, is catered to corporate dollars, gambling, and then the attraction of the new fan. And that might not be always game day ticket sales, but I think it certainly is not just game day, but every day checking in, double tapping, liking, clicking through, and all those other kind of marketing funnels. And I think that's where sports has gone, and I think PLL has this amazing ability to come from, it's being designed today, and every aspect of it is being designed for today's media and today's consumer. That's a, you know, it's a really big leg up, as much as it's hard to build anything in the world. And it's the first league we've seen who's been built in a time where every part of its fabric and foundation is built on how today's consumers are interacting with sports and paying for sports.
And it's interesting because you can, I don't want to say invert it, but you can utilize the comment that you made about how content's being distributed and whether, you know, basically if you live in the United States and you want to see a game, you have to turn on your television. That's your access point to most sports. But whether it's skateboarding or surfing or other elements of the things that have grown in a viral nature in the last 15 years since we've seen the global spread of the internet, you know, you can access new audiences that just find something to, they might not fully understand it, but they find it intriguing for whatever reason or another. And so Now I want to transition into talking about the very, very exciting goings on in the development of international lacrosse, this effort toward being a part of the Olympics in 2028, and your exposure in Nicaragua, understanding that it's a very different concept than trying to create elite level play from the Nicaragua national team. Now, that being said, I'm sure that's not something that you ignore actively, but it is something that, you know, it's not at the core of the mission of what Lacrosse the Nations is and is supposed to be. And so, you know, as you're, I guess, at this point, have you crossed your 10-year threshold? I'm just thinking about this and realizing it now. It's pretty amazing. Can you summarize kind of where it sits and you know, what's on the horizon?
Well, I mean, two parts to that. So I'll kind of answer the second first. Where we are 10 years in. Thank you.
Congratulations, man.
It's incredible. Yeah. 10 years in from that first trip down. Most of the people who went down on that first trip are still involved, if not monthly, then certainly yearly, which is really, really cool, because when you're starting anything, you hope that the early adopters stick with you, and they have. So I'm very proud of that. And where we are, well, Nicaragua has been in the news for a lot of crazy reasons this past year with Daniel Ortega and the resistance they're going through down there. A lot of NGOs and a lot of volunteer work has ceased, obviously being, you know, on such a high travel advisory with the riots and everything. We have been uniquely positioned, and this was maybe what we're most proud of for the past 10 years. We've worked really hard to make this about Nicaraguans leading Nicaraguans. So at any given day, we did have to bring back volunteers, but our programs ran the whole time. Our tutoring, our physical education, our practices were still running every day because it was run by Nicaraguans. And so I'm really, really proud of that. And the leadership down there is just incredible. Norman, our country director in particular, who came through the program and now has been, he's an asset that is as important as any one asset to our organization. So we're also working in Panama now, taking some exploratory trips that I will share in the near future. But we're expanding down there, and to lead into the first part of your question, where our job as LTN is to meet the needs they have today. But to your point, we never went down there with the idea to find the best athletes and produce a Nicaraguan national team. But that said, our mission inside of our mission is to promote and be a conduit to resources and opportunity. So over 10 years, it has become something that they want to play more. And we have a tournament now, and we've implemented the sticks and helmets. And so we are allowing them to set the pace of that, and we will support that. But like everything else, if there's going to be a real team, we want them to own it. And so it continues to be on our mission. And then having something like international, you know, the Olympic talk and everything else that goes along with the kind of like the global boom of the sport, it allows us to say, point to this and say, if, you know, we're never here to limit you. So if this is an opportunity, we will help put together a roadmap for that to happen.
So let me ask about international lacrosse in a different way as well, because, again, you're uniquely well-suited to talk about this. People point to the LA Games in 2028 as being the opportunity. Mm-hmm. We just this week learned or saw I haven't committed to memory what the actual name of the sport is when the host committee gets to choose it, but Paris announced the ones that they're going to put in front of the IOC for approval. I know surfing, you know, three of the sports that were added for Tokyo were included, and breakdancing was, I believe, the fourth that was included. Yeah. So this is the program that folks are looking at in order for lacrosse to be a part of it in 28. You live in LA and have at points in your career lived in LA and been involved in the lacrosse scene for a while. You played for a professional lacrosse team based in LA. What do you think of the idea of Los Angeles being the place where, you know, lacrosse gets to reemerge on an international stage if that comes to fruition?
I really do think it's perfect, because the amount of support in North America for the sport is incredible. So if it's going to launch anywhere, you're going to want somewhere where the fan base comes out and, you know, the opportunities around it, the opportunities to educate the world about the sport. It feels like, you know, Canada and the United States are perfectly suited to do that. So, you know, also me, you know, assuming I will be here, which I have no reason that not to believe that I, you know, wouldn't. I love the idea of it being out here because it's also shows the migration of the sport. And as we continue to grow in our country from east to west with the sport, it seems like it would just be hitting this perfect boiling point of the ability to really blow up.
So one of the things that I'm really excited about in this particular moment in time, and we're recording this on Friday afternoon, so we'll have a Saturday's worth of games been played by the time folks are listening to this, but that's not so much in the scheme of podcast listening. What's really exciting me here in early February, well, I guess at this point, late February, is the NCAA men's lacrosse rules that have been instituted have just made the game so good. And for me, the changes are relatively subtle in the sense that, you know, we're talking about primarily the shot clock. We're talking about a faster clearing clock. You know, I'm with everybody who's a little ambivalent toward the dive rule. And honestly, the shrinking of the substitution box, which was the fourth rule that was changed this past August, hasn't had the same effect that maybe I forecasted. It might just because, you know, we haven't seen this huge uptick in transition that some people predicted. All that being said, the game is so good, and it's a function, in my estimation, of three things, and they kind of all derive from the shot clock. So the first is, seems like there's more chaos, and I'll come back to why I think that is in a second. The second is, the end of shot clocks have been pretty exciting. Like, you haven't had a ton of rolling the ball into the corner. You've had a lot more guys trying to make something happen in the last 10 seconds and removing a lot of risk. John Donowski talked about it with respect to a midfielder named Kevin Quigley's goal against Denver last week and how that was a play that was a smart play because they were going to lose the ball anyway. It was a risky play, but it was the right play in that setting. And then the third is, and this goes hand in hand with the chaos, there's just so much more activity, and it's because you can't throw the ball around waiting for your teammates to sub on and off. And this was something that was always going to be obvious, but I feel like the implementation of it has been subtle because I don't think folks like cognitively understand, and it's because why would you, the fact that lacrosse used to be essentially a 48 or 50-minute game. You know, 10 to 12 minutes were spent cycling the ball while teams were subbing.
Oh, yeah.
And now it's a 60-minute game. So you're increasing the amount of action by like 15%, 20%. And it's had a really meaningful impact on how much excitement unfolds over the course of the game. So, you know, as someone who watched college lacrosse over the last decade after having played in MLL for, you know, such a long period of time that was playing obviously with a shot clock. Have you noticed it? Have you gotten, even from the little that you've been able to see so far, have you gotten a sense for this increased level of activity?
So I think it's unique because I played at UVA and we had a pretty, you know, in my run there, we were a pretty attacking forward team. We didn't really try to take the air out of the ball a whole lot unless situations provided it. What I think this has done, and as you said, I haven't watched a ton of games this year, but I've watched enough to see that it makes everyone kind of play at least this game where I think as a viewer, you get to enjoy both sides of it. Before, it's kind of, do you really enjoy someone taking the air out of the ball and really methodically trying to wear down the team, or do you want to see both players, both teams going up and down, getting rewarded for trying to make a play? And I totally agree that if the rules create safe drama, that's better for everyone who's watching, right? So it's not putting people in a position where they're so tired that they could get hurt or anything like that, but it does allow for, if something's not going smoothly from a viewership standpoint, we'll just wait in 30 seconds. This thing's going to click, and someone's going to have to take a buzzer beater shot. Someone's going to have to make a play. And I think that's what the, I don't think it's so, hasn't changed the sport to me, but what it has done is keep both sides of the field in, more interesting. And I think that's, you know, hopefully that was part of the reason to do it. It just allows for teams to have to train in a certain way to, and by the way, the, this seems to me like I've always wondered, yeah, there's times where you having a long 2 minute possession is important, but usually that came after another team who had the ball for 2 minutes. So now it's kind of both teams are limited to this. And I don't really find that every time you're down the field, you find that no one could set up a play in time because of the shot clock. I think it shows that lacrosse is incredibly fast paced and the skilled players are so talented that the ball gets up the field quickly. In the substitution box, I think what that proves is coaching. I think the only time that 10 yard shorter box makes a difference is with poorly coached teams, because with a really good rotation and understanding, really smart players are going to know to get off the field or get back really quickly. So that 10 less yards doesn't necessarily make a ton of difference, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. That is, if I were looking for an explanation for why my assumption didn't come to fruition, that's well put. But you also said one other thing that I want to re-isolate, which I think is a really important thing for folks to be mindful of. There was fear that the shot clock was going to, ruin might be too strong of a word, but degrade the game. It was going to devolve into chaos. And I said, one of the things I like is that, you know, you're seeing more loose balls at the top of the box that, you know, you've got 3-6 guys going after and it's exciting. But your point is well taken. I agree. I do not think it's changed the game. I think it has made more, it has packed more lacrosse into the 60 minutes, and a significant percentage of the lacrosse that we are seeing is really familiar to what we've been watching, but it's just a function of the fact that, you know, that additional 15 or 20% that used to be spent throwing the ball around is now replaced by even more of, you know, that traditional whatever it is, dodging, passing, transition, face-offs, whatever. And so, I, you know, high marks from me.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, used to come down and spin the ball around a couple times, but that still happens now. It just happens quicker.
Yep.
I think the whole pace of the game, where it used to maybe bounce, 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 and then someone held it for a little bit or jogged with it, no one really, there's just no wasted time. I don't think the players are, I think the players back when I played could have easily handled that too. I mean, back when I played, it wasn't that long ago. I mean, you see the MLL, and the craziest part is the kids in college today, everyone's stick is so sophisticated. I just think it, instead, the rules caught up with the quality of all players on the field.
Right.
So, you know, not to belabor the point, I think that what you said is spot on.
So one thing I wanted to address or get your thought on is Lars Tiffany is in his third year at Charlottesville. He replaced a legend who coached you in Dom Starja, who is now one of the 6 head coaches in PLL, to continue to bring this conversation full circle. Lars also served on the rules committee that enacted these changes, also bringing this full circle. I think that this season was one that UVA fans and alums were anxiously anticipating on the basis of increased talent through the recruiting pipeline, arriving on campus, some of the stars and best-known players, you know, kind of coming into this season with more experience under their belt, Ryan Conrad coming back from injury, and the Cavaliers have gotten off to a 1-2 start, a win over Lehigh sandwiched between losses against on the road against Loyola to open the season. The Greyhounds might be the best team in the country. They're ranked number one as of their game against Rutgers. And high point on Monday, last Monday, and that, you know, we'll see what that loss looks like at the end of the season. Certainly the Panthers look like a top 10, if not top 5 team right now. So what's the mood among the Cavalier faithful?
I don't want to speak for the Cavalier faithful. I'll speak for this faithful Cavalier fan.
Ooh, great turn of phrase.
The first game I did get to watch, and that was arguably one of the top, you know, three or four players in the country was ready to play, and I think they were just overwhelmed. I think Loyola, that loss, UVA, as much talent as they have, still doesn't know who they are. And I think that is a function of, I think they have an identity on one side of the field, and they're finding their identity on what I think is a really, really, really important side of the field, on the defensive side. And a lot of good teams at least have that. There isn't a lot of question marks. Even if there's not a lot of superstars, there's just not a lot of question marks on the defensive side. And I think UVA is still trying to figure that out. And with the pace that they play, that if things go wrong, they can look like they go a lot more off the rails than they actually are. So I think that, not to go through game by game, and I didn't watch the Lehigh game, but I got to see a little bit of each. I think, to your point, High Point, we'll see what that loss looks like at the end of the year. They look pretty good. They've got a couple studs. But I'm actually looking at Princeton as a really cool game to find out who we are, because they have a player that is similar to Spencer in the fact that if you don't check him and he's not, and not just check him one off, but you got to have people sliding to him off the bus. The Sowers kid's pretty impressive.
Yep.
And I know that if they don't contain him and they don't help out there, then that, I don't see it being any easier than any of these other games. You have to be able to neutralize someone, player like that. So I think offensively, they're only going to get better. Krause has been, he started to kick back up even though he's been injured. I think Dox is as good as, a midfielder as we've seen in a long time. Reminds me of kind of like that J.J. Albert type.
Yep.
And so the pieces are all there on offense. I think the identity needs to be settled. The way Coach Tiffany plays, and I love Coach Tiffany. I love the way they play. I also think it will be adjusted throughout the year.
Right.
I mean, they're wide open right now. And then when he finds out where the pieces and places are, it's not all or nothing with him. It's not black or white. I think there's a shade of gray that will be thrown in after they realize who they have.
So I have two reactions. The first is what Lars said after the Loyola loss, which has stuck with me, which is, he came in so positive and so upbeat because he was excited at the opportunity to instill the lessons that needed to be learned on the back of that performance. And then the second thing that sticks with me, and I hope that this wasn't said in confidence, but I was talking to John Torpy after their game against Virginia, and he said, you know, one of the things that is really, I don't remember how he phrased it, and I'm just trying to like kind of share my interpretation, but he basically said, you know, you never feel like you're out of a game because you're too far behind, and you never feel like a lead is safe because you're so far ahead. That's when you're playing Virginia. He's like, that is the nature of how Virginia plays. And I thought that was a really telling comment, because it echoes what you said, which is, because of the way you play, it might not necessarily be as bad as it looks. That rings true, because if it's not as bad as it looks, that means that the amount of improvement that's necessary in order to win games isn't as much as people might assume, outsiders might assume.
I think that's done really, put really well by Coach Torpy and by you. I think the growing isn't necessarily in talent. It's in holding on to leads. It's in recognizing situations. And Lars has been really big on letting the kids be creative. But I think after a few games, each player, Mike Powell is allowed to be a lot more creative than most.
Right.
So I think that's where the team come tournament, you have to put yourself in a position to be there, obviously, but the team come tournament time is going to have those things work themselves out in the locker room. And I also think that's leadership. I think players like Conrad and Docs and you know, the people who are kind of running that ship, they're gonna start demanding the ball, right? It wasn't necessarily a play all the time that Kobe was going to get the ball, but the players and the great teams I've played on, you knew who was going to make the play, and it wasn't. Right now, I feel like it's just wide open up and down, and everyone's kind of trying to find their rhythm. And we'll see. It'll be interesting. I do believe that the defense just has to find an identity, which is probably there needs to be more help on that side of the ball. But that's hard when you play the way they do. So you can't get everything right.
There's one last question or topic that I wanted to touch on with you. And first of all, I want to say that I've really enjoyed this conversation and appreciate your time on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. But last thing I wanted to get to is the idea of recruiting. I know that you've touched this landscape in a number of different ways. One of the things that recently restarted our conversation was I asked about your experience with the Nike Elite Lacrosse Camp as a just, you know, such an innovative idea and experience. And obviously, at that time in your career, you were, you know, working with not just lacrosse, but high school athletes in a number of different sports from at some high level situations. But obviously, and then recently, I know you and I have had a couple conversations about, you know, trying to help shepherd some folks that are in your ecosystem to find the right destination. The implementation of new recruiting legislation that prohibited contact between student athletes and college coaches until September 1st of their junior year went into effect in April of 2017. So coming up on 2 years ago, which is pretty wild. What do you think it's done, and how do you think it's manifested itself?
More on the coaching side, I'd probably have more to say about it, but sure. The amount of stress these kids are under, what it taught me was that it wasn't always the college coaches and the rules that provided the stress, that it was, and as someone who helps out with club teams and truly believes that players need to be playing in these, I think if I can get on a soapbox maybe, and I don't want to, but I do think that we put more pressure on it sometimes than the college coaches are. And that's a function of us making sure we are the best coaches, the best programs, what have you. I've seen more and more that these players are ready to go, and the coaches are actually, you know, outside of the, you know, the crazy ones that everyone talks about and gets, you know, takes a side on and pushes an agenda on. Most of the coaches do want more time, but I think the AAUification of lacrosse is really tricky, and I think it makes the recruiting landscape hard no matter what the rules are. That's probably the part of the sport that I love the most, is the idea of working with the young men and women that I've had a chance to and really push them on understanding what I think it's more important now than ever for high school kids, not to just pick a school, but to, with all the movement from coaches and growth and programs, it's really important for kids to spend time setting goals and understanding what success is and thinking more, about where they want to go. Because as you, nobody 2 years ago at High Point, other than Coach Torpy, was probably saying we can go to the Final Four. And the kids who bought into that are proving that they can. And so with the landscape completely changing, I think it's really, really important for kids to spend more time in the recruiting process, understanding what it is that they want out of the sport. I don't think there's ever a rule, and I'd love to hear your take on this. It's kind of like tampering in the NBA. Like, I don't understand how tampering just means like egregious, because there's nothing to stop Kyrie and KD from talking anytime. And a lot of these rules it just seems like there's so many layers of ways people can get messages across to young athletes. I think it's just really on the mentors and the coaches to shepherd the kids these days. I think that's the most important thing that's happened in lacrosse, because what I've learned is no one rule can really change the landscape. It has to be done by the people in these kids' lives.
So, yeah, I can react to that in a couple ways. I think the first is, depends on what your point of view is on what the rule change was meant to accomplish. Was it meant to eradicate any opportunity or possibility of a coach and a player in a small sample, in a small and quiet setting, agreeing on their, you know, commitment to each other down the road? I don't know. I mean, maybe. I'm sure in principle, in letter of the law, that's what they were going for. But I think that in terms of spirit of the law, the idea was that a climate in which a lot of players' commitments were becoming public so early in their high school careers was a bad look, and it was creating a lot of undue pressure for the sport, for families, for programs, both college and club, etc. I think that was probably a little bit more, you know, what the spirit of the goal of the change was. And so, you know, I think that in that sense, I think it was successful because I don't think.
Do you think?
Sorry, go ahead.
Let me. No, sorry, I didn't mean. But I don't want to. What I think what I was trying to say there was, I do agree that the announcements of sophomores committing has probably dropped. But do you feel that the club landscape has changed the stress for families in the players? I haven't seen that where players are, I think there's more opportunity than ever to play college lacrosse and have the school you go to be good, where it used to be like there's seven schools that have a chance to win this thing and you're kind of with them or yeah, you're on the outside looking in. And I think now there is still, I think there's so much hunger in the sport that it, I don't know if there's a rule. I guess what I was saying is I don't know if there's a rule that really helps medicate that.
So
it seems like the sport and the soccer, basketball, and even in what we did with football, the club all-star circuit, so the elite of the elite, that I think has been actually as much a pressure cooker as the early commitments have, from what I've seen, and I'm not in every market.
No, I would agree. I would agree with you, but my question is it intense for eighth graders and freshmen, or is it intense for sophomores and juniors? Because if it's still intense for eighth graders and freshmen, then it's failed. But I don't think that the argument was ever that the college selection process is stressful whether you're an athlete or not. I don't think the idea is that it shouldn't be harder, that it shouldn't be stressful. I think the idea is that it's inappropriate if it's hard and stressful for eighth graders and ninth graders.
Yeah, I don't know if I think that. I think as a ninth grader, the expectation, because that's where it's changed. Like by the time you're in high school, you want to be on these elite teams. And that's where I think the rule has helped. And it has done that because you don't see the names popping off, so you don't feel like you're so far behind. But I do believe at a local level, and there's no, I'm not saying that there's a way to stop this or that it even is necessarily all bad. But I think what I've seen is less that the eighth graders and the freshmen, and I would even say sophomores, because I don't think sophomores are fully cooked either, but I do believe that the importance in whether it's successful marketing or otherwise, because I've seen plenty of people who aren't on the best teams at the youngest ages do just fine in college and find the right spot and really grow. So I think what it is more of like a local messaging to players that the rules in place for a reason. And I don't know if it necessarily benefits a lot of club teams to really share that with their audience.
Right. No, that's
well, I guess what I was getting to.
Yeah.
Because then I don't want to diminish how important it is to be on the most elite club I offer and how that separates us apart because listen, playing with good players is important, but most parents I've ever talked to, they want their kids on those teams at a young age because that's the way to get recruited.
Right.
And so what I guess I'm saying isn't that I have any bones to pick with it, but it really is the education of the parents and the student athlete.
Well, and in the interest of bringing it back a little bit more full circle, I would say that one of the only things that seems like a practical solution to prevent the idea that I can play at the highest level and that should be what I'm aspiring to unless I'm a special athlete is to make the sport so much bigger than it currently is that, you know, it's like soccer, right? It's like everybody plays soccer in fourth grade because that's what you do. And nobody anticipates being on the U.S. national team, but there are kids out there that are going to, you know, U.S. national team is going to have 23 players on it, and those 23 players are going to come from somewhere. And when they're in fourth grade, they don't know for certain that they're going to be that player. And, you know, it strikes me that that's kind of the only path. Lacrosse has to get to that point before thinking that you can game the system to end up at Johns Hopkins, North Carolina, or Virginia is no longer a realistic thought that folks have when they're in fourth grade.
Yeah, I think that's – that has the growth of our sport is taken a little bit of that away. And then the, you know, if once it's in the Olympics and people start looking at the real long term where it's like, I can play in the professional league, I can play in the Olympics, then your sights get set higher than just UVA, just Johns Hopkins, just whatever. And most of the players who, most of the high performing young athletes that I've worked with, the Division I sport is part of their path. It's not the end of it.
Yep.
And I think that is a really interesting development that I think will take another 5 years or so before we see how viable something like the PLL is or anything that kind of comes from this shakeup. So I think that's why we are in arguably the most exciting time in our sports history. There's more good players than ever. There's more good teams than ever. There's more opportunity than ever. It's just, you know, for young athletes, your time is being vied for on all levels, and it's really hard. And if I don't know who the demo necessarily is on some of these podcasts, but I would just continually tell high school or younger kids and high school players to always look one step up. Watch the PLL, watch the NFL, watch the NBA. But if you're a young pup, go watch your high school too. Don't miss that step. And if you're in high school, go watch the local college and do those things as well as anything else, because it creates a really good path for you. And I think it the stress will be minimized when you're not always comparing yourself against the absolute top of the top.
Well, Brett Hughes, as always, this was a great conversation. Really appreciate your time. Enjoyed talking to you on the Inside the Cross podcast. Best of luck as you continue to endeavor. And we hope to talk to you again sometime down the line.
Terry, always fun. Best of luck to you. And next time I'm in Baltimore, I look forward to catching up face to face.
Inside the Cross podcasts, the source of the sport.